Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org for a study guide outline of today's lesson as Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of John in chapter 18 with The Many Problems of Peter. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We have come to the section of John that deals with the Lord's arrest and his trials leading up to his death on the cross. In this section, we consider the many problems of Peter as he tried to live up to his bold claims that he would remain faithful to the Lord even after others abandoned him. So we are on John chapter 18, starting in verse 10. And remember that the Lord was being confronted by those soldiers and Judas who had come out to arrest him. And so we read, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus." Well, we can see here that Peter isn't ready to just give up, that he is trying to live up to his bold words back in John 13:37. Remember what Peter had said? When he said, "Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake." So he tries to live up to that now, and he pulls out his sword. Now, we might think this is kind of strange that he had a sword, but I think we could find out how it is that he had this if we would turn to the book of Luke in chapter 22, when the Lord, at his last supper with his disciples, said this. It says, "And he said to them, 'When I sent you without money bag, knapsack, and sandals, did you lack anything?' So they said, 'Nothing.' Then he said to them, 'But now, he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack. And he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you that this which is written must still be accomplished in me. He was numbered with the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end.'" So the Lord here reminds his disciples that he had sent them out without any money or knapsack or extra sandals in case there's wear out or anything. And yet he says, "Did you lack for anything?" And they say, "Nothing." See, the Lord was sending them under his protection, with his help, with his power, to keep them from needing anything. But now the Lord is about to leave them. So he tells them, "If you have money, better bring it along. If you have a knapsack to carry your possessions in, you better carry it." And before, they had had protection from the Lord. They didn't need a sword to protect themselves from highway robbers or anything. But he says, "If you don't have a sword now, you better sell your garment and buy one, your extra clothes, and buy one, because now you're not going to have protection anymore. Because," he says, "it's going to still be accomplished in me what is written, he was numbered with the transgressors." In other words, he's about to die, and so they're going to have to take care of themselves from now on. Now, verse 38, it says, "So they said, 'Look, here are two swords.' And he said to them, 'It is enough.'" It seems they take him very literally there, and they say, "Oh, you think we should have a sword? Here are two of them. We've got two swords." Well, I don't know that the Lord literally meant that they needed to grab a sword right then. He just meant they needed means to protect themselves now because he wasn't going to be around to protect them anymore. But when they said, "We found two swords," he said, "Fine, that's plenty." I don't think that was really what he meant. But the fact was that they had two swords, and it seems that one of those who strapped on a sword was Peter. He had one of these two swords from Luke 22:38. So when he sees these soldiers coming to arrest Jesus, he pulls out this sword. Now, he attacks the high priest's servant. And in Greek, that is the high priest's servant, and it probably means that he was the one in charge. Of course, we've already read of the captain that was over the officers, but this was the high priest's servant who was probably over the servants who were there. So this guy is one in charge, so he becomes Peter's target. So he draws his sword and swings at him, and he cuts off his right ear. Now, I don't suppose that Peter was trying to cut off his ear, but remember, he's a fisherman. He's not a soldier. So he takes out this sword, something he's not used to wielding at all, and he swings it wildly. He's probably aiming for the guy's head, trying to cut it in half. But he misses, or else the guy kind of ducks aside, and instead of cutting his head in half, he just cuts off his ear. Verse 11. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into the sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?" Now imagine what this must have seemed like to Peter. Remember that in the few verses before this, he had just seen the Lord speak a word. Say, "I am." And he'd seen all these men, these soldiers and all those that come out to arrest him, fall backwards and fall to the ground at the Lord's word. Now, how is it that the Lord could not defend himself? But the Lord doesn't. He says to Peter to put his sword back into the sheath, to stop trying to fight. And his justification is, "Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?" He says, "This is the cup. This is the suffering that the Father has for me. I have to go through this. And I can't avoid it." Now imagine what must be going through Peter's mind at this point. Remember, he has, like I said, boldly told the Lord that he would be willing to lay down his life for his sake. But remember what Peter thinks about the Lord. We've seen earlier when Peter stated his belief that Jesus is indeed the Christ. He is the Messiah, the one who was supposed to come, supposed to be the King of Israel, supposed to save them from their enemies, supposed to lead them like Moses led them, supposed to lead them like David led them, make them an independent, autonomous nation again, and restore things to the way God wanted them to be in Israel. Peter knows that. And not only that, but he actually believes, as he told the Lord, that he believes that he is the Son of God. He realizes that Christ is God represented in human form. Now he imagines that Christ has come, as I said, to fulfill all those messianic prophecies, to save Israel from the Romans. And so he and his fellow disciples have just been waiting for that final battle where the Lord is going to finally take up the sword, finally going to have a military confrontation with the Romans, and going to free Israel at last. And so Peter, when he says, "I'd be willing to lay down my life for your sake," and that's what he's thinking. See, he's thinking that they're all standing there with their swords, and their backers are behind them, and they're facing off with the Romans, maybe legions of Romans coming out, marching out to battle them. And he, Peter, is standing there with his sword, and all the other disciples have swords, and here the Romans are coming to attack. And maybe the Lord is calling on his power and sending down great blasts of fire from heaven that are burning Romans off their feet. And maybe he calls legions of angels down and they're swooping down from heaven and grabbing up Roman soldiers and doing who knows what to them. And the battle's going on. And here's Peter with his sword, and here come maybe three Romans. He's going to fight three Roman soldiers at once because suddenly he's not Peter the fisherman anymore. The Lord's empowering him and he's a super warrior. So he's fighting these three Romans single-handedly and wielding the sword like a pro, and he takes out two of these Romans, one, two, but maybe while he's doing that, the third gets him, stabs him with his sword. And so Peter's lying there dying, and the Lord comes and standing over him, he says, "Thank you, Peter. Thank you for being willing to die for my kingdom." And then Peter dies there heroically on the battlefield, fighting to bring the Lord's kingdom to earth. See, that's what he's been imagining. That's what he's been thinking. And so when he tells the Lord, "I'd be willing to lay down my life for your sake." See, people tend to really give Peter a hard time. Say, Peter said that, but he was just rash. He hadn't really thought about it. He really didn't know what he was saying. He said that, and when the time came, he wasn't able to live up to it. He hadn't really counted the cost. Well, no, I think Peter had thought about it. I think Peter had realized that he was willing to lay down his life for the Lord in a battle like that. And if we had any reason to doubt it, well, Peter shows it here. Here they are facing off with 600 soldiers, as we saw last time, a cohort with 600 soldiers. And here Peter, he's one of two disciples with a sword, and then he pulls out his sword, and he's ready to fight these 600 soldiers. And Peter was ready to die in a situation like that. So when he said he would lay down his life for the Lord's sake, he had thought about it, and he shows here that he's ready to do it. But the thing was, how could Peter possibly have anticipated what actually happened? How could he, in his wildest dreams, have imagined that the Lord would just stand there and let himself get arrested? And that he, Peter, laying down his life for the Lord's sake would mean that he would have to stand there and let himself get arrested too, and get carried off and put on trial, maybe to be stoned to death or maybe even to be hung on a cross and be executed. Just stand there, let himself get arrested with the Lord and die with the Lord. How could he possibly have anticipated that? And he wasn't ready for any such thing. So he had anticipated trouble when he spoke his bold words about laying down his life for the Lord's sake, but he had never anticipated this. I think in some ways he can't blame him for not anticipating it. How could he possibly have known? But the fact was, when the time came, when the actual situation arose, the one he hadn't anticipated, he wasn't ready for it at all. And he was not ready to lay down his life this way. Verse 12. Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. So now they arrest him. And there's no doubt about it, the Lord allowed himself to be arrested. Because like I said, just a few verses back, he had just spoken a word and they'd all fall into the ground. Well, if he could have done that, he could have spoken the word and they would all have fallen down dead. Or he could have called legions of angels to defend himself. But he allowed himself to be arrested. This was all part of God's plan. And as he said, he has to drink the cup the Father's given him. Now, the detachment of troops and the captain. And again, like I told you last time, that word detachment is a cohort. It means 600 soldiers. And the word captain there is the Greek chiliarch, which means a commander of 1,000 soldiers. Now, as I told you last time, these two words, cohort and chiliarch, are normally Roman words used for Roman soldiers. But that is really the only evidence in any of the four Gospels that we have that there were any Roman soldiers in the garden at all. And all the other evidence we have says that these troops, that these soldiers and captains and everybody, came from the chief priests, came from the Jews, that they were Jewish. And the only indication we have that there were Roman soldiers here in the garden at Lord's arrest are these two Roman words. Now, I tend to think that John is writing to a very broad audience, an audience that would not really know the Aramaic Jewish words for soldiers. And if John had used the typical Jewish words for soldiers, they would have scratched their heads and say, well, what in the world does that mean? But they all knew the word cohort. Oh, that means 600 soldiers. And they all knew the word chiliarch. Oh, that means commander of 1,000. So I think that John probably borrowed these Roman words to refer to a largely Jewish force, or completely Jewish force, I should say. And this chiliarch is not actually a Roman soldier at all, but he's the captain in charge of the temple guard. And that's what I tend to think. I don't think that there were any Roman soldiers here. I could be wrong, of course, and no big deal if I am. But I think these two words is mighty slim evidence for there being Roman soldiers here. If there were, of course, the chief priests had somehow roped them in by claiming that the Lord was a dangerous rebel. But I don't see really much evidence for that. These couple words I don't think is enough. I think these were all Jewish soldiers. Now, it says that they arrested the Lord and bound him. Now, why should they bind him when he was coming willingly? Well, again, perhaps for show. They wanted to be very political and act like he was this dangerous criminal that they were arresting. And so they bound him like a dangerous criminal. Verse 13. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now, Annas was the one they led him away to first. And if there were Roman soldiers again here, why would they have led him away to a Jewish high priest after they arrested him? Wouldn't they have led him away to the Romans? So again, that shows us that these were Jewish soldiers arresting him. Now, Annas had actually been the high priest back at the start of the Lord's ministry. And now he is just the high priest's father-in-law. The high priest had married his daughter. So he still has influence, but he's not the high priest. Now, if you don't know anything about the law in the Old Testament, you would know that this is not the way it was supposed to be. Because the way God had set it up, when a man was appointed high priest, he was high priest for life. The first high priest was Aaron, remember, Moses' brother. And he was high priest till he died. And then one of his sons was set up, and he was high priest till he died, and so on and so forth. And that was the law, the way it was supposed to be. Once you were a high priest, you were a high priest for life. Unlike the other priestly service, where you're only high priest until you reached a certain age, and then you had to retire. The high priest was high priest for life. And in fact, there was even a rule that for accidental manslaughter, that when you had accidentally killed somebody, you ran to a city of refuge, and you stayed there until the death of the high priest. Well, that required that the high priest stay high priest for life. Because if you retired and somebody else was appointed, well, how are you supposed to decide whose death meant you were free from the city of refuge? Was it the former high priest or the one who's high priest now? Or maybe there's a guy who was high priest before him, another one was high priest before him. Which one has to die before you're free? Well, obviously, the high priest was supposed to be high priest for life. Now, what had happened, it was because of Jewish political squabbles and fighting and this party versus that party, and that party takes over and says, oh, that high priest was of the other party. we're going to depose him and put another high priest in his place. And Josephus makes note of that in his history, the first time a high priest was deposed during his lifetime and somebody else set up. And that was a great affront against the laws of the Lord, that their political infighting would cause them to break his law and to change his law that way. But remember, these Jewish leaders, they didn't seem to care about that. They cared much more about maintaining their own tradition than they cared about maintaining the laws of the Lord. And this was just another way that they committed abomination against the Lord's laws and changed them and corrupted them. Now, at this point, it even seems possible that they changed it so there was a new high priest every year, which, of course, was even more of an affront to the Lord's law. Now, Annas, we know from his history that he was skilled in the law. So it seems that the reason they bring him to him first, rather than to the high priest, is so that he might find some charge they can trump up against him. Because remember, they really had no legitimate charge against him. So whatever might have been true in the garden, there were certainly no Romans here because they had just brought him into the house of a Jew, the father-in-law of the high priest. Verse 14. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. So John reminds us of what we'd read back in John chapter 11. When the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the Sanhedrin together because not only the common people, but now many of the Jews, their fellow rich ruling class, were believing in the Lord because of the resurrection of Lazarus. And the Sanhedrin said to each other, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone but like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place," of course that means the temple, "and nation." And notice how they view the nation of Israel as being theirs rather than being the Lord's. And that shows their attitude. But John 11:49, it says, "And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year," notice that year, the high priest is supposed to be priest for life, but they just made him priest for a year. So it says, "High priest that year said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish.'" So he suggests the plan that they should have the Lord put to death, so that in his mind, it would save the nation, because if the Lord keeps going around doing what he's doing, and he just believed that the Lord would preach revolt against Rome eventually, he hadn't yet, but he believes he will eventually, like all the false messiahs had done before him, he says the Romans will come and destroy our people, so we need to save our nation by killing him. Now, that was a very nefarious plan, but we read in verse 51, "Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad." So Caiaphas, even though in his mind he was speaking a murderous plot to destroy the Lord, in reality, because he was the high priest, the Lord actually used him to prophesy and to say the truth, that Christ was going to die for that nation, not in the schemes of the religious leaders, but in the Lord's plan. Yes, this was the cup that the Lord Jesus had to drink. Back in John 18, verse 15. "And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest, and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest." So how does this work? Well, remember, according to Mark chapter 14 and verse 50, it tells us, "Then they all forsook him and fled." So we realize that after the Lord was arrested in the garden, all his disciples had fled. They'd all abandoned him. They'd all run away. But it seems that Peter and another disciple, after they had run, they soon got a hold of themselves and said, "Wait a minute, we can't abandon the Lord like this." And they turned around to follow him. And so they had gotten over their panic and had at least followed him at a distance, not abandoned him completely. Well, that was good as far as it went. Now, who is this another disciple who is known to the high priest? Well, this is something people puzzle over. Some have wondered if, because he was known to the high priest and got led into the courtyard of the high priest, that maybe this was somebody really important, like Nicodemus, the Pharisee, the one who came to him by night, or Joseph of Arimathea, the one who helped Nicodemus at his burial. The Companion Bible suggests one of those two. But if that was the case, my question would be, why didn't John name him here as he did elsewhere? Why didn't he say this was Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea? I don't see any reason why he wouldn't have named him. Some of us suggested it could have been Lazarus. Because remember, we know that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, their family, were part of the rich ruling class in Israel. And we suggested they might have even owned the small suburb of Jerusalem, Bethany, because they were so important. But remember, Lazarus was the one disciple among all the disciples who was actually wanted by the high priests and religious leaders as much as the Lord. Remember that from John 12. Because many of their fellow Jews were believing in Christ because of the resurrection of Lazarus, they wanted to arrest Lazarus too. And remember I told you in Mark 14 when that mysterious episode where a young man, they try to arrest him, and he shrugs out of his clothes, they've grabbed his clothes, he shrugs out of them and runs away naked. I think that's Lazarus. And the reason Mark doesn't give his name is because he was still wanted when Mark is writing his gospel, and he didn't want to stir up more trouble for him. So he mentions the incident, but doesn't mention Lazarus' name. So I think the last person who could have marched up to the home of the high priest and demanded entrance would have been Lazarus. He would have been arrested on the spot. But I think this other disciple was John, the author of this book, the disciple. Because remember, John often in this book refers to himself as if he's referring to someone else. I showed you that way back in John chapter 1, where he identifies himself as the author while speaking as if he was speaking of someone else. He says there was a man sent from God whose name was John in John 1:6. I told you I think that's the author of the book identifying himself, but acting like he's talking about someone else. And in John 13:23, he referred to himself and said, "Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved." And there he doesn't even name himself, but I think that's the author of the book identifying himself. Remember, we talked about why doesn't he name himself, and I said, well, the purpose of this book, the Gospel of John, is to produce believers in the fact that Jesus is the Christ, the one anointed or marked out by God to be the Savior of the world, and that Jesus is the Son of God, or God represented in human form. And so the book is to bring glory to Jesus Christ. And yet if John had brought himself into the foreground and talked about himself in this book, people could have said, well, he just wrote these things about Jesus Christ in order to bring glory to himself. So John wanted to make it clear that he wanted to give all the glory to Jesus Christ and none to himself. So I think that's why he kept himself in the background. Well, how would John have been known to the high priest, we might ask then? Well, remember, we know very little about the backgrounds of any of the Lord's disciples. James and John, we know, and their father were in a fishing business. And so were Peter and Andrew. And yet, when it comes right down to it, being part of the rich class in Israel wasn't about how much wealth you had. It was hereditary. You were born into the rich class. It was like the caste system in India. And it didn't matter if a man became rich. If he was part of the poor class, that didn't make him rich, even just because he got wealth. And if part of the rich class had become impoverished, lost his wealth, he wouldn't have become part of the poor class. It was about birth, not about how much money you had. So it's possible that James and John, even though they're fishermen, and so are Peter and Andrew, that Peter and Andrew are part of the poor class, and James and John are part of the rich. And if so, John might have been educated more than a lot of the disciples. And we see in John chapter 1, he talks about the Logos. Well, that was something that the educated in Israel tended to talk about. So there's evidence that John could have been of the rich class. And if so, he's the type of person who could have gotten himself into the courtyard of the high priest, whereas the other disciples couldn't. Verse 16, "But Peter stood at the door outside. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in." So Peter, it seems, waits at the gate while John scouts ahead. And then John returns to convince the porter to let Peter in, which he does. It's apparently a young girl keeping the door. It seems that was a task they often gave to young girls in Israel. So in this portion, we see that when Peter claimed he was ready to die rather than abandon the Lord, he really meant what he said. And he was ready to in a fierce battle. But Peter never imagined what actually took place, just standing there to get arrested. And when the time came, he was not nearly as strong as he thought he was. That's a good lesson for us. We need God's strength if we are to serve him faithfully. In our own strength, like Peter did, we would fail.
In order to live the life that God would have us to live, it is imperative that we possess the strength of God. Ephesians 3 tells us that this strength comes from His Spirit and that He would dwell in our hearts by faith. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the book of John. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of John with the denials of Peter. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you learn more of God's Word, you know God more. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also offer a free weekly email newsletter. Currently, Nathan is studying through the book of Colossians in this newsletter and is doing the same thing he does on this radio program, going verse by verse through Colossians and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on his mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible Studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry at P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although your donations are greatly appreciated, we will never solicit you for funds and your email will never be shared. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say goodbye for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.